KYUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city. Stream us anytime at www.ciut.fm.
Welcome to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. And I'm Phil Taylor, your host. I started to talk about another show. We are going to be talking to a couple of very important people at this juncture in time. We're going to be speaking to Professor Michael Link. He is a former United Nations rapporteur on Palestine and was really quite distinguished in his work there, and he's been succeeded by an equally gifted, I think, international lawyer, Albanese, who is often in the headlines, but Michael was in that role, and since the big story of the day has to do with Gaza, Israel, Palestine. We want to find out about where international law comes into any of this, because we're hearing about deals, et cetera. Later in the show, we'll be talking to Tony Leah of Unifor, because there was a big demonstration of by Unifor in Brampton, and it's sort of the important issue of the closing of plants and the protection of jobs. And so we'll be talking about that in the latter part of the show. But at the moment, I think we're joined by Professor Michael Link. Are you there, sir?
How are you, Phil?
Very good. I'm glad to be talking to you because, of course, Donald Trump produces political cocktails about every 2 weeks that have everybody scrambling. But just before we went on the air, I was looking at an article which said, to put it negatively, there is no international law involved in what is being talked about here. There seems to be a kind of political arrangement. I understand they're meeting in Cairo today. It's some kind of bizarre, I'm calling it bizarre, plan of Donald Trump. He's going to be the chairman of the board. Tony Blair is allegedly involved as the administrator. But you function in the area of international law, protection of the rights of states and nationalities, ethnic groups, etc. How is all this talk? What do you make of this in terms of what's the right of self-determination of Palestinians, their identity as a state, all those things? How does it, if you could explain it to us, I'd appreciate.
Sure. Well, what we have, as most people would know, is what is called a 20-point Trump plan for peace in the Middle East. Many people have reviewed it. I certainly have gone through the details that have been listed. And I think that the preconditions for a successful peace plan and what we've learned from the failures of prior peace proposals in the Middle East, we're not going to get to peace with this particular plan. And I say that for a couple of reasons. First, what a peace plan requires as a precondition for success is clarity, not ambiguity. And this plan is full of ambiguity and very loose details. Second of all, for a plan to succeed, it needs explicit timelines for agreements to wind up occurring. And beyond the release of the Israeli hostages and the Palestinian detainees, there are virtually no details with regards to timelines that have to be met in this agreement. Thirdly, we would need to have a credible and swift pathway for Palestinian states. That's entirely absent. Fourth, as you've mentioned, this needs to be grounded in international law and UN resolutions. And again, that is absolutely absent. Entirely absent from these proposals. And fifth and finally, there needs to be a commitment and an understanding by the United States to politically enforce the plan and the agreement. And I think the chances are very low that this administration will wind up doing that. So I'm not at all optimistic beyond what may happen in the next few weeks with respect to the release of the Israeli hostages and the Palestinian detainees, that this plan will last for very long.
Yeah. What you outlined there, the ambiguities part, I mean, this has been, you know, we've watched Israel in dealing with its neighbors, Syria, Lebanon, activity, well, the bombing of Iran, and there were, in all, each of those, there were agreements that had that element you're talking about, ambiguity, because in the middle of them, suddenly Israel attacked. And they did it based on, because there's a gray area. And they said, well, no, they said they were going to do this, and the time's up.
Yes. If we review what's gone on for the last, over the last 45 or so years with respect to agreements to bring about peace in the Middle East. The three ones we have in particular are the 1979 Camp David Agreement that was led by President Jimmy Carter, the 1993 Oslo Agreement that was signed on the White House lawn under President Bill Clinton, and the 2003 roadmap that was developed under George Bush the second. Mm-hmm. And the two fatal flaws in all three of those agreements were the unwillingness of the United States to enforce the agreement when it came to the Palestinians, and it was not grounded in international law or UN resolutions. And all three of those plans, those were entirely absent. It's absent now even more starkly with respect to this peace proposal. Mm-hmm. So you've raised a very good point. I don't think that I'm putting forth the proposition that there cannot be a successful pathway to peace between Israelis and Palestinians unless and until it's grounded in a rights-based approach that is anchored in international law and this big body of UN resolutions. It's not as if we don't know what the components of a rights-based peace plan are. It's the unwillingness of Israel to live up to international law and UN resolutions, and the unwillingness of the United States to force them to do so.
Mm-hmm. I guess there's another question tied to that. Is the assumption that they're going to put this in a little package and say, well, okay, and then bring it to the UN and say, we want you to endorse this? Or is there a language that relates it to the United Nations?
I don't see that language in what has been proposed. And I doubt if, after these negotiations in Cairo over the next several days, if they do reach a meeting of minds, there will be much reference to the United Nations, if at all. And there's no requirement for the United Nations, for the United States and Israel and Hamas to bring this to the United Nations for approval. There may well be a move by the United States to want to have the Security Council adopt a resolution approving this. That could happen. But as I said, I think this plan is unlikely to get very far beyond the release of the hostages and the Palestinian detainees. Mm-hmm. And if it crumbles before there is an opportunity to present a resolution at the Security Council, then all bets are off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would assume, thinking about it, that they would, it's always been suspected that or assumed that Israel would like to get the return of their of the hostages and then say, okay, now we resume. You recall when there was the first exchanges, by the way, that was working. People forget that there was a period there where the hostages and prisoners being held in Israel were being exchanged. And it looked, I think, from the Western or U.S. point of view, perhaps Netanyahu's, as too happy an event. It was almost like they were going to resolve it. But then they resumed combat. And which seems to be their, you know, preferred mode, right?
You're absolutely right. I mean, virtually all of the Israeli hostages that and foreign hostages that were taken 2 years ago have been released through negotiations. There's only been a handful of hostages that have been released through direct military action or intervention by Israel.
And then, and in one case, they killed those hostages, right? When the hostages came to them and said, hey, we're Israelis, and they were killed.
Yes, right. There were three hostages who had escaped from their captors. They were crossing a field with I believe, white flags, and they were killed by Israeli snipers.
Yeah.
So one wonders, I mean, if, you know, let's be clear, you know, the taking of civilian hostages is illegal under mm-hmm. international law, and the killing of civilians mm-hmm. Is illegal under international law in virtually all circumstances. But in this particular war, the release of hostages was primarily going to be achieved through negotiations rather than war and trying to locate them, which Israel, despite its advanced intelligence capabilities, has been unable to locate most of the hostages over these 2 years. Then the pursuit of war is, as many Israeli families of hostages have argued over and over again, that was unlikely to produce the recovery of their loved ones.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Professor Michael Link. He was the special UN special rapporteur on the human rights in Palestine 2016 to 2022. What this situation of this condition of the people of Gaza now? We went through a period where, it, as horrible as it was, there was a United Nations relief work, which has gone goes all the way back to 1949. Then there was a, I would call it a propaganda episode, where they said, oh, the people who work for that UNRWA are sympathetic or part of Hamas. And Canada even immediately stopped their aid, support for UNRWA, and several countries did it. Then it was established that it seemed to be primarily simply propaganda, but they didn't. It's never been effectively resumed, right? So the basic problem of feeding people, providing medicine, etc., that is seems to, as far as I know, is up in the air. And what future is there? Are they factored into any of this talk about ceasefire negotiations? Where is UNRWA going to be?
UNRWA may well be excluded from any future in Gaza and the West Bank.
That's an attack on the UN itself.
Oh, it is. And let's keep in mind the United Nations General Assembly. This is not well known. Did ask the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which is the highest-ranking judicial body in our international system, for what is called an advisory opinion on whether or not Israel was violating its obligations as a United Nations member in blocking the United Nations operations in the occupied Palestinian territory, which is not Israeli territory. There were arguments in the end of April and beginning of May in The Hague in front of the court, between all the countries who participated in the hearings in front of the International Court of Justice, argued that Israel was in fact in breach of its obligations. That decision is likely to come out in the next 2 weeks from the ICJ in The Hague, and I suspect it will probably find that Israel has been in violation of its obligations, and then it's up to the international community as to what to do with Israel's, if you like, flagrant violation once more of international law.
Well, the idea is the ugly shadow over this is that they created, again, this is just something in Trump's hip pocket, but there's something called the Gaza Humanitarian whatever, basically a private operation involving armed people, by the way, as I understand it, you could correct me, and with a wholesale approach to providing food, which is to say, okay, we're going to have the food at this corner and everybody come and get it, whereas UNRWA has a very organized and systematic way of supplying necessities to people, which involves identification, where they come to the area and they say, you know, we know the families here. Here's, you bring your identification, you get your proportion. This other thing is just some kind of slap-together show, which also involves Israeli supervision, which leads to civilians being shot.
Yeah.
What is that thing that they've created?
Yeah,
I think
you're absolutely
they're creating.
Right. In the period of time up until the beginning of March 2025, UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, along with a number of private international humanitarian organizations, had conducted a relatively efficient way of being able to bring in humanitarian aid, food, water, sanitation, tents and shelter to the 2.2 million Palestinians living in Gaza. They had set up around 400 different distribution sites all around Gaza, basically bringing humanitarian aid to where they were. They were then unilaterally halted in their efforts by Israel at the beginning of March of 2025, and for 11 weeks, not a single truck of humanitarian aid was able to enter into Gaza because of Israel's complete blockade and siege of the Strip. When aid finally did resume in late May of 2025, Israel forbade the UN, for the most part, from being able to involve in the delivery of humanitarian aid, and it created the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation with Israeli and American money, with Israeli soldiers and American mercenaries, I can't think of a better word, to run these. And instead of having 400 sites to distribute aid, they only had four sites, one in central Gaza and three in the south, which meant, and by this time, we had reached extreme starvation, which eventually led to the declaration by the UN that parts of Gaza were now in a famine zone. So you had people in serious health conditions because of a lack of food, a lack of water, having to walk 5, 10, 15 kilometers to these four distribution sites in order to be able to carry back huge packages back to their family. There's been an estimated to be around 1,400 Palestinians have either been killed by the American soldiers or the ex-soldiers or the IDF of the Israeli Defense Forces, or crushed in panic towards the distribution of food during this period of time since they've been operating over the last 5 months. Mm. So all of this, I think, is distressing. It's probably one of the worst examples of how to wind up distributing humanitarian aid in a war zone and in a famine zone.
I need to ask you, I know we're taking a lot of your time, we do appreciate, I want to ask you this phenomenon, which just only weeks ago, days, recognition of the state by several Western states, and the argument over its significance, but it is rather significant in that the Trump thing seems to be some sort of concoction that doesn't recognize such things as states, or it says it will look down the road. I mean, we're going with the U.S. model of how to solve everything, but actually the recognition of the Palestinian state does become more and more important. That is, as a UN, as a member of the United Nations, et cetera, as against the Trump plan. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Well, to be a state recognized by the United Nations, and therefore being given a seat along with the 193 countries that have already achieved membership, you need to be approved by the Security Council. And the United States has consistently used its veto power to block the ability of the state of Palestine to be recognized as a member of the United Nations. It's the only country on the Security Council that's been voting against that. At the General Assembly, they don't have the power to admit a applicant to be full, to become a full state, but they do have the power to give them something almost that status, and that's what they've done as a pushback to the American veto, is elevate the state that there is a state of Palestine, and it's a observer state status at the UN. Mm-hmm. The recognition by countries like France, Britain, Australia, Canada, of the state of Palestine is a good step, but if it's only left at the level of symbolism, mm-hmm. Then it really will have achieved nothing more than theater or performance. Let's keep in mind, the extraordinary difficulties we face in achieving a Palestinian state, and that is because of Israel's settlement enterprise. In 2016, the UN Security Council passed a resolution condemning the Israeli settlements as a flagrant violation under international law, and that resolution said that the Israeli settlement enterprise is, and I'm quoting, dangerously imperiling the chances of a two-state solution. At that point in time, there were 400,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank alone. Mm-hmm. Go forward to 2025, when French President Emmanuel Macron spoke last month at the UN Security Council. He was pushing the idea of having a two-state solution and chaired the UN summit. He said in his speech to the UN that we are just a few minutes away from midnight when the door will completely close. And now we have 525,000 settlers. Israeli settlers living illegally in the West Bank alone. The mathematics of trying to achieve a Palestinian state in the face of this galloping enterprise by Israel is daunting. And I've never heard any of the countries which are now recognizing a Palestinian state as to what their strategy is to wind up getting there.
We're up there at the old line of Mr. Sharon. He said, we don't care about all this talk. We're going to establish facts on the ground, and then come back in 10 years and say, "Look, it's over. Why are you people still talking about this?" Right?
Yes, I'm afraid that's so. We've heard 5 minutes to midnight with respect to a Palestinian state for almost 20 years, and in many ways, having the West say, we believe in a two-state solution, is Israel's sweet spot. Because as long as the West keeps on saying there's a possibility of a Palestinian state, which we support, that allows Israel to keep on putting another 20 to 25,000 settlers a year in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, without the West saying putting any consequences on Israel to end this illegality.
Mm-hmm. I think I'd like, if I can, to get one more question to that. We've just had a rather heroic effort by more than 50 ships to reach the people of Gaza with aid, led by Greta Thunberg. And it's really quite remarkable. And actually, some states got involved in the sense. Spain sent ships, and I believe Turkey might. Maybe it was Greece. At any rate, quite a remarkable moment. I'd just like you to tell us whose waters were they sailing into? Because Israel will be there and they will be blocking. And once they reach a certain point, Israel will assert itself. But whose waters are those?
They were taken. These boats were apprehended by the Israeli Navy, either in international waters, which would be illegal, or in the waters of what would be the state of Palestine, which is also illegal. You know, we know from UN resolutions and from rulings coming from the International Court of Justice that the Israeli occupation is unlawful and must end as rapidly as possible. By asserting control and indeed a claim of sovereignty over the Palestinian territory, Israel is asserting an illegal assertion of control over the sea off the coast of Gaza. So either if they were apprehended in international waters or apprehended in the waters of Gaza and Palestine, the Israeli actions with respect to these boats, this flotilla, was entirely illegal under international law.
Yeah. I'm really glad you underlined that. Professor Michael Link, it's a pleasure to talk to you about such terrible things, and we do appreciate it very, very much. Thank you.
Phil, thank you very much for having me.
All right. That's Professor Michael Link, University of Ottawa. I think he's retired. He's also an authority on labor law, but has been writing and speaking on this subject for many years, very, very persuasively, I might add. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. We're going to play a little bit of probably an appropriate tune, and we will come back and we will talk to Tony Lee of Unifor.